Show me the money.
This is the Money Web Be a Better Investor podcast, picking the brains of professional investors on their investment strategies, successes, and mistakes. Your host, Rake Fanica.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Be a Better Investor podcast. My name is Rake van Niekerk, and in this podcast series, I speak to leading professional investors about their investment journeys. We look at their first investments and how their investment strategies have changed over the years. We also look at their personal portfolios to see whether they practice what they preach. And the idea is to identify a few golden nuggets of wisdom to help amateur retail investors to become better investors. My guest today is Dhirenya Mathura. She is a fund manager at Melville Douglas. Now, Melville Douglas is an interesting company. It's a boutique investment management company within Standard Bank, and it's well known for its global and international funds. Dhirenya holds an honors in finance from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and she is a CFA charter holder. Dhirenya, thank you so much for coming into the MoneyWeb studio and to share your insights with us. And I'm going to jump in there. Just tell us the Dhirenya story. Where did you grow up and what shaped your ambition to become a professional investor?
So thanks for having me. So in terms of my journey, I think I actually decided fairly earlier on that I wanted to be in investment. So I grew up in Durban and I attended Kingsway High School. And when I was in grade 11, there was a presentation of various career opportunities. And one of the presentations was around valuing companies. And I don't know why it stuck with me. I think at that stage it was valuing a resort. And basically, how do you actually determine the value of this company? And it was at the back of my mind, and actually it stuck with me. And so when I got to matric and I had to kind of choose what I wanted to study at university, I kind of explained that I wanted to study kind of valuing a company. And so that was kind of then described as finance. And so I then did my business science, and that includes honors in finance. And then you do learn a lot about companies and valuing companies. So very similar to kind of the job that I actually do today, but actually I identify that that was what I was interested in very early on. And so I did my degree and I enjoyed what I was studying. And so when it was time to look for a job, I went into graduate programs. So I applied for various graduate programs, trying to sort of break into equities, which is actually quite difficult to do. I don't think there's quite a lot of opportunities at that age. Once you have experience, there's a lot more opportunities. So I got into the RMB graduate program. And so I remember I got accepted into corporate finance and equities. But I was really passionate about what I actually wanted to do, even though I was quite young at that stage. And so I got into the RMB equities graduate program. And it was really great because it gave me the opportunity to rotate around various businesses within the equities division.
And in many cases, that's when you realize how complicated this world is.
And I think it's about increases with having the opportunity to go to different parts of the equities business.
But let's rewind a bit to your grade 11 meeting where you heard the term valuing companies, because that is what it's all about. You need to buy shares in a company and you need to know what they are worth. Following that engagement, did you start to look at valuations of companies through a investment lens?
So I think that more raised my awareness to what it was about. And then for me, the next step was I wanted to know more. And so it was more about understanding what I should study at university that kind of enables me to kind of pursue this. I mean, initially, I thought I would study accounting and become a CA. But then as I explored more and this kind of sparked me exploring further, I actually realized, well, there's other career opportunities that are more direct to kind of get me to where I want to be, seeing I actually think I know where I want to be. And so that's why I did business science. And then I was already aware at that stage that you could do a CFA. And that's basically like a master's in valuing companies and equities and markets. So that's what I spent the time doing after listening to that presentation, finding the right route to kind of learn more about this. And once I started working in equities, that's when I started investing in equities.
That's my next question. When did you start to invest your own money? Because obviously you can't only value companies to see a number. You actually want to, you know, exploit the valuation if there is an opportunity. So when were you first exposed to investment or actually made your first investment?
So I participated in some of the BEE schemes that were at place when I first joined RMB. So I think I was probably 22, 23. I remember I still have those MTN shares that I got in that BEE
scheme. They performed really well.
And at that stage, I mean, telcos was still quite a considerable growth opportunity. That's about 16, 15 years ago now. So I thought it was an attractive story. And I remember going through the whole process of filling in the forms and having to take it to the post office to get my shares. So that was the first investment I made. And when I was about 25, I remember my boss at the time said, look at what equities have done over the long term, and it matters that you start early. And so immediately then I also opened up a Satrix account and I bought an automatic debit order in terms of having a market tracker, and it automatically took money off my salary every month, and I knew I was invested in the market. So I initially started off quite broad because I didn't know the companies in much detail. But when I joined Melville Douglas on the buy side and I was doing all the work on companies, I opened a trading account and obviously started trading individual shares within that, first domestically. And then as I grew to know offshore companies, then I opened an offshore trading account and started trading there.
Now tell us about that trading account. What was your strategy there? What was your approach?
Well, given the fact that I work at an asset manager and in a bank, my strategy and approach have to be consistent with what our investment view is at Melville Douglas, because we're not allowed to kind of put trades that are against what we're doing for clients.
When you first started, did you only start when you were at Melville Douglas?
I had broader general kind of trackers, but at Melville Douglas, and I specifically had a more live.
So you can only invest in your own funds, is that the policy?
You can invest in the shares that you hold as a company, but you do have to get approval for it. So for example, if the company is selling the share and you're buying the share, you kind of have to make a lot of justifications. Typically, you would trade in line with what your house view is, because we're trading for clients. And so if we're advising them to do that, you shouldn't then in your personal capacity be doing something
else. That's always an interesting policy, because you are still very young and in many cases you would invest people's pension money, and the risk profile is totally different to what your risk profile would be.
So in terms of that though, I manage our global equity fund. So that is a fully invested equity product. It doesn't have any restrictions in terms of the risk profile of the client. How you'd manage the risk profile of the client would be the weight that they have in that fund. So in terms of a philosophy and process, that's where the restrictions come in, as in we would only hold shares in our fund that meets our philosophy and process, which is a quality growth style. But my personal investment view aligns with our invest. I think that's why I love my job and I'm passionate about it and I believe in it, because I also personally believe in quality growth companies being able to outperform over the long term and share prices following companies' earnings. So my personal portfolio is then aligned with our global equity fund.
So explain that strategy or that investment view to us so we can exactly understand how your mind works when you pick those shares.
So we're looking for a quality growth company. So how would we look at that? Well, firstly, we'd start with, okay, it's quality. So what does that mean? And one of the things for us is, does that mean it has a competitive moat? So when you think of a moat, you think of a huge castle and water surrounding it, preventing enemies from getting in. And that's how we look at companies too, because it needs to have something that enables it to be unique, a defendable competitive advantage, so all the competitors can't do the same thing and basically erode any competitive edge it has. It needs to have a defendable competitive advantage. So when we're looking for quality, we're looking for a company that has that. So for example, the company should have pricing power. If you think of a luxury company, so LVMH owns Louis Vuitton, they own Dior. A lot of their brands have a history of over 100 years. So if I wanted to start a luxury company tomorrow, yes, I could start it, but nobody's going to believe it's luxury because it doesn't have heritage. And so it needs 100 years, basically, to qualify for heritage and to be a luxury company. So that means it gets pricing power. And there's various different ways of having a sustainable moat and a competitive advantage. And that's what we look for in companies. What's unique about it that protects it from competition?
So you're looking at blue chip stocks. That's what you're saying.
Yes. And so I believe in that personally, and that is what our investment philosophy is in my job as well. So it aligns that my personal portfolio is very linked to my professional portfolio, and that basically aligns my own interests as well to our clients. So it worked out well that I'm in a house that has a philosophy that I personally believe in.
Well, you're probably part of the house that formulates, or the team that formulates that policy and vision. Do you like investing in shares or individual companies or funds?
Individual companies. Again, I will be restricted to what we own. But I do have a mix in my portfolio of individual companies, and I've got some ETFs as well for broader market exposure. It's just in my particular line of work, I have to get approval to invest. And so if there's a big market sell-off and I want to invest immediately, it's easier for me then to go via an ETF because I don't need to get approval for that. But yeah, ultimately, I believe in doing the work on the companies that you see having a competitive edge and investing in those.
Bureaucracy in an investment company. It sounds actually quite strange, but obviously compliance is one of the key corporate governance principles within those firms. Obviously, you will have a pension contributions made. Let's put that aside, because normally those are in managed funds. You have got an influence in which assets those funds are invested, but most people do not. They belong to a pension fund, or they belong to a retirement annuity, and then they, with an advisor, pick one or two funds, and then it stays relatively stable. I want to speak about your discretionary portfolio over and above your pension fund contributions. Can you describe your risk profile and how you approach those investments from a risks perspective?
So I think I still have quite a long-term investment horizon. So my risk profile is then a function of that. I think when people think of equities, they typically probably don't understand it as much, and they think it's very risky. And over short periods of time, yes, it can be risky, because the stats actually show that if you look at the probability of making a negative return over one day in equities, it's probably close to 50%. But if you stretch that out to a decade, the probability of making a negative return goes to about 10%. If you stretch that out 40 years, it goes close to 0%. So I think for me, given my long-term investment horizon, I mean, I'm thinking I would probably be working for quite a few more years as well, the majority of my portfolio is equities, given I have a long-term investment horizon. So everything outside of my retirement fund, other than my property, is in equities. So the bulk of my investments, given that I think over a long-term investment horizon, equities will outperform other asset classes, the bulk sits there. And then I have a mix between domestic and offshore, and I have a skew to offshore, given that my salary is tied to domestic markets. I live in South Africa, so I want to diversify. And so I get my diversification through splitting more offshore. So I would say it's probably 70% offshore.
Do you own crypto?
I don't own crypto. As a fundamental analyst, I struggle to value crypto. And so I don't invest in something I don't understand. And I can't see what drives the value.
See, it's an interesting debate. I've had many people with gray hair like me, you know, raving about crypto, and then young professionals say, listen, I can't value it, so I'm not going to touch it.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, like, I'm a fundamental investor, so I need to be able to understand the fundamentals and be able to understand predicting the demand, predicting the supply, and being able to value it. And if my experience is, if I don't understand something, I shouldn't invest in it.
What would your advice be for a young professional entering the job market? Say 22, 23-year-old, starting with a good job, a good salary. That individual wants to start to invest. I'm talking about discretionary investments, not pension fund investment, because that gives you some skin in the game. You start to understand and learn what markets are and how they behave. But many people make mistakes because it's not easy to get more winners in your portfolio than to avoid the losers. How do you think somebody should approach starting and discretionary share portfolio?
I would say if the person doesn't have a lot of in-depth knowledge about shares, it's quite difficult then to be able to pick, as you say, the winners and the losers. So probably start with broader market exposure or sector exposure. So if you think, for example, there's quite a lot of opportunity within tech for the next few years, maybe buy a tech tracker fund, or also look at what investment funds they are available. So like at Melville Douglas, we have a global equity feeder fund. You can go onto the website, you can fill out the form, and then that gives you exposure to blue chip quality growth companies if that's what your preference is for. So maybe start off by identifying your investment style, as in, do you think quality growth companies will do better, or do you think cheaper value?
But how do you do that if you're 21?
It's your preference. That's why you have a broader index tracker, I think, at the beginning. But even as a 20, 21-year-old investor, I think you should be reading. And if you think that there's a lot of opportunity in tech, then you should buy a tech tracker fund or buy a tech fund. So I think you should do some reading in terms of where you think growth opportunities are. Otherwise, the only other option is then you buy a broad market tracker. So I think people maybe can start with a broad market tracker, but I think it's really useful to actually know about what you're investing in. So you should be reading and should be understanding what you're investing in. Even if you're investing in a broader market tracker, read about markets. I mean, that's your personal wealth that's tied into that. So you should be aware of what you're investing in.
I support you 100%. Read and read and read and read. And that is how you learn. But there are always conflicting views. How do you distill the relevant information from, you know, noise in the market?
Yeah, for me, a lot of my job is actually focusing on the fundamentals and ignoring the noise. And it's hard to do because there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of news flow. But for us, as I said, I always come back to valuing a company. And so based on the information I have and my best expectations of the future, what do I think the value is? If I think the value is significantly higher and the stock's down 40% because of news flow at the time, then it's a buying opportunity for me. So I focus on the long term. So that's the one thing. And I hopefully then try not get sucked up in the short-term noise. So there may be a short-term issue, but over the long term, what do I think will happen? And then based on that view, I make a decision.
That's a sound theory. It's not so easy to execute.
It isn't very easy to execute, but you've got to try your best when you're managing people's money. They're entrusting you to do that and to be a custodian of it. So you've got to try and block out the noise.
Okay, Darinia, now the two big questions. Let's start with the negative one first. What do you think has been your worst investment ever you have made in a personal capacity?
Worst investment.
I normally get a giggle.
Yeah, there's a few. I had some EOH shares at some point, and everybody would know what happened with those shares. So I think that's probably my worst investment. I think nobody really understood, like management was saying, and that's a lesson. Management was saying one thing and reassuring the market, but in the background, a lot of things were happening. And so I guess you always question what you're hearing.
When did you buy those shares?
I'm trying to think now when I...
Because the company performed really well a few years ago.
Yeah, so initially it had done well. So maybe if I've been at Melville Douglas for 11 years, maybe about 9 years or so ago. No, initially it did well, but then all the issues crept up. And I guess I didn't get out fast enough. And so it was quite painful.
When you see shares declining, you know, hope starts to become an investment strategy. And that is really not a good
investment
absolutely
strategy.
Not. So your best one ever, which one, when you boast about your abilities, which one do you boast about the most?
I think the tech stocks, I think as a collective, have done quite well. The Microsofts, the Alphabets, the Metas.
But that's only been the last 5 years they've really performed.
Five, six. I actually think, though, in my portfolio, like the tech stocks have actually done quite well over the last 7 or 8 years globally. I don't really have any domestic tech stocks.
But there were some explosions over the last few years, especially in the AI space.
Yeah, I think you had to ride out the volatility. And equity does come out. It does have volatility. And you've got to kind of, again, try and focus on the long term to what do I think it's worth? And as I said as well, you might have short-term volatility in equity returns, but if you look at what it actually returns over a long period of time, you can see that it actually does quite well. So I think it's just to not be watching screens and panicking when markets are falling. Try not to do that and focus on the fact that you've got a long-term investment horizon.
Again, I don't think it's easy to execute such a strategy because emotion is so prevalent. And I want to get some free investment advice now. Say somebody who has invested in NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, and the Magnificent Seven. Some have performed much better than others, especially Microsoft and NVIDIA. When do you get out? Because we've seen significant rallies in those stocks. You're talking about in 2-3 years, close to 200% returns. Do you get out, or how should you think about the possibility of taking profits?
So one thing we look at is valuation. So even though NVIDIA's share price was up like 150% year to date, we look at what you call a PE ratio. So the valuation of the company to the earnings you're getting. And on that basis, actually, NVIDIA isn't as extreme. I think it was at about 40 times. And so from that perspective, if you look at its long-term average, I think it sits at about 40 times. And so the earnings have gone up as much as the price has been going up. So if it doesn't look extreme to us on a valuation perspective, like looking at it on a price to earnings, then we would be comfortable. What would make us sell if that was maybe the long-term average is like 40 times and it was trading 2 standard deviations above that? That's quite extreme. Then you would look to either cut the position or sell. Or if something's drastically changed in the investment case, has someone else come up with a chip that is similar to NVIDIA's, better than NVIDIA's, and that just erodes their competitive advantage? It doesn't look like that is expected. It could come in the future, but it doesn't look like that's on the near-term investment horizon. Then you would sell out of it because the competitive moat's been eroded.
Tarinia, thank you so much for coming into the studio today and for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Tarinia Mathura. She is a fund manager at Melville Douglas.
Show me the money.
That was The Money Web, the A Better Investor podcast with Rafe Van Niekerk. Thanks for listening. Catch up and listen to all the MoneyWeb podcasts on moneyweb.co.za or the app. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.